come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Donald Hall, one of the undoubtedly most important living poets in the English language. He was poet laureate. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has over 30 books, over 20 books of poetry. He's now approaching his late 80s, and he just come out with a new book, Essays After 80. And it's a fantastic read. It's all about aging, and it's about poetry. So join us. You're not going to want to miss this one. One of the quotes in the book that I want to read to you, he says, "Because of multiple drafts, I have been accused of self-discipline. Really, I am self-indulgent." And as a writer, I completely understand this concept. I write every day. Well, one day a week I don't write, but I write every day. And I have a friend who lives in Spain, and who knows, maybe she'll be more of a friend. I'll keep you posted. But she always marvels at how disciplined I am. And this is an accomplished woman. She's a scholar. She's a tenured professor. She's more articulate than I am in three languages. And she thinks I'm disciplined. She thinks I'm disciplined. But the fact is, it's not that I'm disciplined. It's that I don't know how not to write. If I go a couple of days without writing, I go crazy. This is not a discipline. It's an indulgence. It's like somebody saying, "Hey, Chacon, I saw you scarf down that double cheeseburger with bacon, the whole thing. What discipline?" No, it's not discipline. If you're a writer, and I mean a writer, and you know when you say something twice, it means something different. When you're a writer, the discipline is not writing. I try to take one day off a week, a de facto Shabbos, a Sabbath, el sábado. I take it on Saturday, not for religious reasons, but because I think the human spirit needs one day off. I think one day without thinking of your daily routine, without thinking, in fact, without doing your work, it refreshes you in creative ways. But it's hard to do. It is a discipline to not do anything. Try it. Try one day of doing absolutely nothing, and you'll find it's one of the hardest things you can do. That is discipline. So I take Saturday off. It takes all my discipline, all my strength not to write. But sometimes I even cheat. Instead of writing, I'll speak some passage into my voice recorder on my iPhone. It's a discipline not to write. I'm reminded of a story my sociology teacher told us in seventh grade. His name was Mr. Belmont. And he said that there's two kids taking piano lessons. And one kid, you have to force him to practice. The parents are, "You practice that piano, you practice it." And the kid begrudgingly goes to the piano. And the other kid, you can't shut her up. She's always playing piano, always. And the parents say, "Would you stop it? We're trying to sleep." And then Mr. Belmont looks at us. He crosses his arms and he says, "Who's going to turn out to be the pianist?" And the answer, well, it's obvious, right? Writers cannot not write. And although this may seem out of context to some of you, here's a metaphor I sometimes use to explain my obsession, my lack of discipline not to write. When things were going bad for Jesus, what? He's talking about Jesus? When things were going bad for Jesus, he said to his disciples, everybody was abandoning him. He was about to be crucified and everyone would be afraid to be associated with him. And he says to his disciples, he says, "Are you going to leave me too?" And the disciple looks at him and says, "What else do we have?" And that's how I feel about writing. Once you become a writer, once you start writing, once you get into that zone, once you indulge in the practice, it's like you've talked to God. What else is there? Now, we're going to talk to one of the undoubtedly most important writers of our time. Oh, but I want to warn you, he is in a rural New Hampshire farm that his grandparents owned and his great-grandparents owned, and so the reception isn't that good. You might want to find a quiet place to listen to this interview. It's well worth it, and he has a lot of wisdom to share with us, so stick around. Donald Hall is, a very well-known poet. He is author of 50 books across several genres, including children's literature, biography, memoir, essays, and 22 volumes of poems. He is a former poet laureate, U.S. poet laureate, and he is the very first editor of the Paris Review. He also received a National Letter of Arts, which was given to him by President Obama himself. We're going to talk about his latest book, Essays After 80. Donald Hall, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Delighted to be here.
Essays After 80. This is your new book, and I've just finished reading it. It's a fantastic collection of essays.
Thank you.
On aging and on poetry and on relationships. And before we get into some specific questions about the book, how did the book come about and why? Why now?
It was strange. I had a letter one day from a woman who's a marvelous artist who makes tiny books that sell for $150, beautifully made. And she suggested that I write a book about looking out the window. And I thought about it, and I told her, no, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And then I went up to sitting by the window, and I started writing it. When I had finished it, I realized that it should have a bigger audience than the, 15 people who would buy an expensive book. So I asked her permission, and she gave it to me. And I sold it to the New Yorker, and I had a tremendous response to it, letters and so on, telephone calls. And that got me started. And I began to write, I think, two more at the same time. And usually I wrote the whole book, but I usually had maybe essays in three stages. One that was just beginning, one about in the middle of revision, and another about finished. And I love to revise. I always love to revise. Poetry or prose. I like revising better than I do writing. And some of these essays, three or four of them, took 80 drafts, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I loved every minute of it. I'm not complaining. I'm bragging.
Yeah, in fact, you say that the greatest pleasure in writing is rewriting. And you say because you write multiple drafts, you have been accused of self-discipline. But that's not what it is. It's
right.
Not self-discipline. It's indulgence.
Self-indulgence. Absolutely.
I love that because, I have people who accuse me of being disciplined, but I'm not disciplined. It's like, what else am I going to do? It's like Philip Roth said to you. I love that moment you had with Philip Roth. And you hadn't seen each other in years. And he looks at you and he says, how you doing? He says, I'm still writing. And he says, what else is there?
Right. I remember that well. Yeah.
You say that old age is a ceremony of losses. Can you explain what that means?
One after another, you lose various things. Obvious things. I can't drive anymore. And they come to different people at different times. My balance is terrible, and I live and take care of myself. But I push around a rollator, four wheels on it, and I don't try to walk without it. So I don't want to fall down. There are losses, and I'm terribly fortunate in that one thing that has not left me is the thing I like most, which is writing, and I'm still doing it. I'm working on the next book and maybe on the next book.
You're in your great-grandmother's house. Do you still spend a lot of time by the window? I love that image of you just looking out.
That's right.
The barn. You see the landscape that you've known all your life.
That's what I'm looking at right now.
There must be, by being there in this landscape that you grew up in, it must cause you to every single corner must have a memory.
Absolutely. It has so much memory. Because I used to come here when my grandparents lived here when I was 8 and 10 years old. I stayed with my grandfather. And then my late wife and I moved back here in 1975. I wanted to live here, but I never thought I could. And I managed to, and to make a living by freelance writing. And of course, we changed it. We built in bookcases and so on. But it's a house I knew in, 1938, still here.
In one of your essays, you talk about the decades of your life. And you say that during the 40s, you were drunk. During your 50s, you said that was a great time, and that 50s kind of lasted into your 60s. And I'm in my 50s now, and I'm really interested in this whole idea of aging. I often tell my friends, I don't mind getting old. It's a lot better than the alternative.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in, especially now that I'm in my 50s, I'm finding my 50s to be the most amazing time in my life.
I'm glad to hear it.
And I want to know why you found your 50s so incredible.
Because of a great change in my life. I think it's very useful in your late 40s or your 50s to change what you have been doing and start something new. Well, I have been a professor for many years at the University of Michigan, and I stopped that, moved to a very different place, to the place of my childhood adoration, and wrote all the time. In Michigan, I could write when I didn't have anything to do with preparing a lecture or correcting papers. But I always knew I was going to go into the other world. And here, it was just working all day long. By the way, the word work has only meant writing in my life. When I was teaching, I didn't regard a lecture as my work because it was sort of obvious, something I could do with my left hand. But writing was something else that's what I adored. But here I could do it all day long and make a living by writing. Mm. I had, you know, health insurance and retirement, and I never looked at the financial page. I didn't have to think about it. Well, I came here and lost all that and had to build in, and I had to make money. So I made some money by doing poetry readings, but I did a lot more by writing a couple of textbooks and by writing children's books. So I wrote a dozen children's books and lots of work for magazines. I'm not sure I could do it now because magazines have diminished, and they'll pay so much because they don't make so much. But at any rate, when it was a heyday for magazines while I was doing it, I'm not retired because I still work, but I'm not making enough per year to live on. I just saved up.
So I'm a professor at the University of Texas in the creative writing program here in El Paso.
Oh, yeah.
And I always look forward to retirement so I could work more.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
It sounds like you had an early retirement. But I'm wondering if there's also something else about the 50s, being in your 50s, that's transforming. Because even though you say in your 40s you drank, and you know, we kind of laugh at that, the fact is, in your 50s, is it a lot easier to negotiate and deal with your addictions, no matter what they are, and to be more focused, yet your body is still young enough to function at full level?
A lot happened for me, certainly. Well, I associated with, you know, the change of place and the change of culture, as well as being fortunate to be in this particular house. In Ann Arbor, there were lots of parties every weekend. There were sort of two cocktail parties on Friday that you had to go to, and three on Saturday. And it was a well-known statement, maybe it is for your college too, but that at any party, one-third of the people had not been in town the year before, and one-third would not be there the next year. There was nothing that really persisted year in, year out. And the culture was very social. And I've said that here in Ann Arbor, dinner parties are banned by the state constitution. I might be exaggerating a little. But no, it's not a party place. We're in the country. And there are a few cities in New Hampshire. But I can see one house from this window, and that's exactly the same house I could see 40 years ago.
Yeah, and you also say that was also back in the days when people drank liquor.
Yes, I even mean that nowadays. Well, back then, people talked about the three martini lunch.
Yeah.
You met your publisher in New York. I don't think that even in New York they have three martinis anymore.
Well, I think there used to be, you know, this acceptability when writers used to be able to go to parties and get drunk and make fools of themselves, and now they just can't do that anymore. It's just, quite a stigma.
Yeah.
You also talk about old age as an unknown galaxy, and you realize at a certain point you're an extraterrestrial. you know, you're obviously, you're writing essays, you're doing incredible work, you have all this time to read and to think, but sometimes people, when they see you, and they see you in your beard and your disheveled head and you're in a wheelchair, the one incident is bent down to you and said very, you know, well, as if he was speaking to a child, "Did you like your din-din?
Did we have a nice din-din?" That's what he said. I was already writing that essay, the Out the Window essay, and I needed something which was kind of a countermotion to the peace and stability of me looking out the window. And I went to the museum, and it happened. I was grateful to the idiot for condescending so easily. And I also liked it. You know, somebody in the newspaper writes a letter and says, "Well, I seem to be a nice old gentleman." How does she know I'm nice old gentleman? She knows I'm old, okay. But those are words of condescension, really.
Absolutely. And the fact is that now you have a beard. You've had a beard three times in your life, and
right.
Each time they represented a stage of, you know, really of your artistic and your development in general. But this beard now is a crazy beard. Anyone just looks at the cover of this, and it's crazy. And your hair is, by the way, I admire your full head of hair. Your hair is all wild and crazy.
Yeah.
And somebody referred to you as Yeti, Bigfoot. You know, I'm wondering if on some level that you encourage this kind of attention because it subverts that condescension that some people have towards old people.
Exactly. I do that. I want to look outlandish. And I do. And my head, yes, is hair in all directions. I believe that the back of my head is bald. But fortunately, I don't know it.
You don't see that part.
If somebody takes a picture of me from behind, I am shocked. I consider myself a hairy beast.
You kind of allude to this in your essays, that there is some both insecurity and arrogance in being a poet, and there is some sort of ego involved.
And I guess so.
And I know, I'm getting in my 50s, and I guess I have ego, and one time I did this poetry reading on a stage with lights, and I saw the video of it, and you could see my scalp.
Really?
I couldn't believe it. You could see my scalp, and you know, and I had no idea that you could, that my hair was thinning that much. First thing I do is I went out and bought a hat. And so now I look like, you know, I think, okay, it's just a look. But it's really these ways we have of, you kind of talk linguistically, we have these ways of avoiding the idea of death. We don't say, you know, "I'm going to be dead." We say somebody passed away. We say somebody bought the boat, or we say, you know, something like this. I'm wondering how that struggle to suddenly know that you're going to face death, how that struggle, you know, affects, you know, how you live your life and how you write your poetry.
When I was 70, 75, I was horrified about death. And I wrote about it, a terrible thing ahead of me. And I no longer feel that way at all. I'm obviously closer to it. Mm-hmm. It could happen every minute. Right. And I said, "Don't give a damn." And by the way, you would never in the world catch me saying, "Pass away." I'm always
right.
Yelling at people who say it. I say, "Die." I say, "Death." I don't say, "Departure," or "pass away," or "pass," or any of those euphemisms. I really loathe them. And I want to be able, not to dwell on death, but to know it's there.
Right.
It happens to all of us. Unbelievable. And I'm living in the present. People always tell you, live in the moment. Well, when you're 86, you better do that.
You write that poems are image bursts from brain depths.
Yeah.
I love that description because they are. You know, you get this image and, you know, however you follow it, whether it's through sound or through narrative. I mean, but you also say in a few lines later that when testosterone diminishes, ... you don't finish the statement.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. I think I can understand. I think I can finish the sentence that poetry is partly rooted in the body. It's partly rooted in the sensual.
I take poetry, it is bodily, it's a bodily art. And when I read a good book of poems silently in my chair, my throat gets tired. The mouth, the throat, the organs of speech are involved, and I sort of imagine they're working. I think the poetry is extremely erotic.
Really?
When the testosterone diminishes, poetry diminishes. I find myself able to write prose. I'm proud of my prose. But not able to write poetry anymore. And it is because, for me, sound is a sort of doorway into poetry. And when I was writing my best stuff, I could really taste it, and I knew that I was speaking out of some place that was more body than it was brain. And I felt it diminished on me slowly. It wasn't a sudden lack and a depression about it. I simply saw it go, and I saw it go the way I see death coming. And I think, okay, that's the way it is. But very fortunately for my pleasure in life, I'm able to write prose.
I'm talking to Donald Hall, you know, may I say it, the great poet, who just came out with a new book called Essays After 80. We're talking about poetry and eroticism. You call Paradise Lost the most erotic poem ever written.
Yeah, it might really be Keats, but I wanted to make it the pure Keats poem.
Yeah.
It is enormously dependent on its sound, beautifully. I love it for its body.
And one time a woman said to you, she says, I want to put my legs around your head. And all you could think of is that it's iambic pentameter. I want to put my legs around your head.
Excuse me, but it's not the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I just noticed that, yes.
These essays, they cover a lot of ground about not only your experience as a poet, like, for example, one of the things I did not know, and this is out of the essay, Thank You, Thank You, Thank You, is how relatively new poetry readings are to writing poetry. You said in 1948 there were 15 poetry readings in the U.S. and 12 of them were Robert Frost.
I allow us how I made up the figures.
Yeah.
But it was approximately true. I grew up in it. And really, when the phone rang, and an agent introduced himself and wanted to get me a reading, I could not believe it. That was back in the 50s. You know, I didn't think it would last, but of course, there's more and more poetry readings now.
Right.
And I've done certainly an enormous number. I just wish I had some notion in my head of how many I've done. I don't do them anymore. It's one of the limitations. I was always flying to California and doing a meeting, you know. I can't do that anymore. With the prose book, I've been to three local places and read aloud some bits of it and signed books with people. But I can't go for Boston or New York. You know.
Right. Today, it's inconceivable that a poet would come out with a book without doing multiple readings. In fact, publishers won't even publish them if they're not willing to do readings. I'm wondering if that phenomenon has had an effect on the way we write poetry.
I think it has had a great effect on the poems we write. Most of it good, but not entirely. Because when you're writing, when I was writing at the beginning of readings, one time I found myself making a revision, and I knew it wasn't quite the right words, but I caught myself saying, I can say it so that it's all right. Well, you have to write poems so that they are good on the page and good out loud. I think sometimes probably read a good many poems, which might work well out loud, but don't work well on the page.
One of your last poetry readings, at this point you couldn't stand up, you were in a chair reading, after you were done, you got incredible applause and you got a standing ovation, and then later on you thought, was the poem really that good? And you came up with a realization. Can you tell us about what it is that you realized?
Well, I had more standing ovations than I've ever had in my life, and finally I realized that they know that it's the last time they're going to see me. That was fine. It's true. My old thing. But, maybe I was doing a little corrective on my egotism. It wasn't because I was suddenly so wonderful. It was because I was so old.
Well, I applaud you and stand up for this book, Essays After 80. I think it's a fantastic book. And not because it's going to be your last. I'm sure there's going to be more as you're sitting by your window. Thank you, Donald Hall, for joining me on Words on a Wire.
I've had a good time talking with you.
On Poem of the Week, we're going to read something by Donald Hall. It's called A Beard for a Blue Pantry, and reading the poem will be Getsani, Montaño, Sevilla.
A Beard for a Blue Pantry. Bluebeard displayed his wives in a gallery small as a pantry. My wife Jane has leukemia, and I sit by her painful bed as pétiché bloom on her skin and white cells proliferate. The summer after we married, I grew a black beard, and Jane wrote a poem on an airplane flying home from California. The first 8 days of the beard. After a dozen years, I shaved that curly and tractable beard when it turned as white as King Arthur in the pantry, where Amos the cat birdwatched from a yellow bread box, our fury Attila of mice, until his eyes glazed over. In those deliberate days, Jane made bread so honest. Once it went blue in the pantry on a hot August weekend. In a room above the kitchen, she worked at her poems, and in spring paused to garden, and in winter to feed goldfinches, black soil, sunflower seed. On days that started with coffee in bed and continued with walking, the dog, with loving, with baking, with answering Alice's letters, with mulching roses, and washing abundant hair that is gone now in her terrible illness. It is blue in the breadless pantry. And that was A Beard for a Blue Pantry by Donald Hall.
I'd like to thank my guest, Donald Hall, for joining us for this edition of Words on a Wire. Pick up that book, Essays After 80. I learned quite a bit reading it, and it's really beautifully written, very vivid. Even though he claims not to have the testosterone to write poetry anymore, it is like poetry. It is a beautiful book, and I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk to him. I'd also like to thank Ketsani for reading that wonderful poem from Donald Hall. It got me to think that Donald Hall is, I think, the third poet laureate, U.S. poet laureate, that we've had on this show. We had Philip Levine was our first poet laureate. He was poet laureate at the time. I asked him, so what are you going to do as poet laureate of the United States? And he answered, as little as possible. And then we had Billy Collins on the show, and he did quite a bit when he was poet laureate. He did these poetry in the school campaign. He came up with this book of Poetry 101, where he tried to introduce poetry to school children. He was quite active, and he was a fun guest. You can actually go in the KTEP archives under Words on a Wire and listen to the poet laureates. And we also had Mark Strand. Was Mark Strand a poet laureate? Well, even if he wasn't, we had Mark Strand on the show, and he recently died. He didn't pass away. He didn't kick the bucket. He died. I'm really honored that I got a chance to talk to him about his latest book, the last book he wrote before he died. One of the things Donald Hall says in his book, he says, there are no happy endings because happiness doesn't end. It's really sad that we had to say goodbye to Mark Strand. He's an incredible poet. But good poetry does not die, only the people who read it. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.